Blog Talk Radio.
Why must we feel our futures so uncertain? Why must we feel our presence is a burden? Living day to day off crumbs from the table. This dependency must end. I know that we are able to build a life.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله Brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi ta'ala wa barakatuh. Alhamdulillah, thank you for joining us for Wealth Creation Preservation Day. What we're going to do, my interest for us this week is for us to better understand the idea of network effects. And of course, my commentary is going to come after the first hour of our broadcast. But I want to kind of set you up for being in the right mode of listening for this. This is an interview that was done about 2 years ago, but just recently shared online. And I just discovered, actually, it was a year or so ago. In any case, it is the founder of Intuit. So Intuit is known for the TurboTax and QuickBooks and that whole company. Well, this person is the founder of Intuit, which is the mother company of the TurboTax and QuickBooks et al. That we have some familiarity with. He's being interviewed by a gentleman, James Currier, from the site Network Effects. Its letters are NFX. So we're going to play about a half hour of this interview. It's actually a 47-minute interview, but enough for us to get a feel for, get a sense of the significance of network effects. In fact, this founder, Scott Cook, he has, written a book, or he's the go-to person to understand network effects if you are founding a company. And so I want you to hear it in that sense. I don't think there's much jargon in there that will literally throw you off of the conversation. But in any case, it's important for us to increase our vocabulary always. So this is why top founders understand network effects. That is, the successful ones are the ones who understand network effects. And so there's some very important history of some of the companies that we all know and have engaged, and how the network effects either affected them, affects them, or makes them successful, and what perhaps has caused them to fail in other areas, their failure to understand the impact of network effects, and how some of their various strategies were undermined by the reality of network effects. So, inshallah, listen well, take notes, and inshallah, we'll be talking to you in a little bit. Assalamu alaikum.
This is Kristen O'Brien, Managing Editor at NFX, and you're listening to the NFX Podcast. We're talking about the power of network effects in this episode with Scott Cook, founder and chairman of Intuit, and James Currier, partner at NFX. About 2 years ago, Scott came to NFX to meet with James and discuss their shared interest in network effects. It was one of the most compelling conversations James has had with anyone on the topic. So today, we're at the Intuit headquarters in Mountain View, California, to continue the conversation and make it public for the benefit of founders everywhere.
Today, Scott Cook and I are talking through network effects. And, the audience, Scott, is founders, and mostly early stage founders. And so they're looking for practical tips, tools, stories, details, and of things that they can use in their daily lives. And, 2 years ago, you and I had a chance to discover that we're both network effects wonks, right? We're students of network effects. And we had a great talk about them in detail, and there aren't that many people actually who have spent the time, as you have, to figure out the nuances and how they work and that sort of thing. And so I just thought it would be great for us to almost recreate our discussion about network effects so that founders could benefit from the sharing of some of the details about this stuff and some of the thinking. And just to set the stage so founders understand, are you and your family office still investing in companies?
Oh, we do some. In the pre-K education field, we do a lot, as much as we can find, as that's our kind of philanthropic purpose. And then on the side for personal portfolio, once in a while.
Once in a while. Mm-hmm. And is there a particular type of thing you're looking for? Companies with network effects?
You're always looking for companies with network effects.
Yeah.
Yeah, generally they won't be at the earliest stage because that's pre-establishing of a network effect. But so there might be when there's some evidence of market traction and then a team and a business you can believe in.
Got it. And you talked a lot about the need for founders to have their durable competitive advantages long-term. What does that mean to you?
Maybe there was a time when you could start a company and not have to worry about competitors. But in the world we live in today, with giants that have such speed and agility and resources, whether it's Facebook, Google, Amazon, whether it's other startups, the vibrant startup infrastructure, you've got to assume that there are going to be other people trying to do the same thing as you, either at the same time or once they see that it's successful. And if you don't have a source of durable advantage, well, you're a roadkill. All that work goes to nothing, and you get crushed.
Yeah.
So I don't – and then not only to survive, but to thrive, the size of your profit stream is largely a function of your size of durable advantage. Because if you don't have durable advantage, you'll have 18 competitors, and they'll compete it down to no economic return.
And what forms does that durable advantage take? One of the things that we did, we published a perspective that in the digital age, there's sort of four major things. If you discount IP, particularly in software, it's tough to use IP. But you've got brand, you've got embedding, where, like an Oracle will embed their software in a company. You've got scale, like an Amazon just gets scale, so the prices get lower. And then you've got network effects. And we kind of posit that network effects are the greatest of the four. Do you have any way of looking at durable advantages like that that might be a framework that the founders could learn from?
Yeah, it's similar, and the conclusion is exactly the same, that the one biggie, the giant in the room, are network effects. The others all have their flaws. So a traditional one was fixed cost scale leverage, but that assumes that nobody else could put the fixed cost in. Well, today with the tech titans out there, they can put the fixed cost in a wink, in a blink. So fixed cost scale leverage assumes a capital constrained world, and we live, at least in tech, with companies that are seemingly capital unconstrained. So that doesn't have the power it used to. One that gets some discussion is switching cost. There was a time when certain companies would have unique access to a source of supply, like De Beers with diamonds. But, boy, you don't tend to see that anymore. And so
the assets of the new economy is just data and software, and all that moves very easily.
And brand, I think, is not a worthy defense at all. I've seen companies with phenomenal brands get crushed in a matter of years. I mean, go back to times that we remember in the early age of PC software. The best brands in the industry were Lotus and Lotus 1-2-3, WordPerfect, and Microsoft just crushed them in a matter of years. And they had the brands. So I don't think brand buys you very much. I mean, the best brand in search was, you name it, Alta Vista or maybe Yahoo, and they're roadkill. So I just don't think brand matters that much anymore. It's too, if you go back, if you look, where brand used to matter a lot was in, say, consumer household products like those made appear on a grocery or drugstore shelf. And those are product categories where the consumer already has been using the product for years, just ran out, has to rebuy. The product only costs $3. They walk by that shelf twice a week, okay? All you have to do to get them to try your brand is get them, they're going to reach out toward the shelf, and they just have to move their hand 20 centimeters to pick up your brand, okay? Maybe brand image could make someone who's going to buy anyway move their hand 20 centimeters to buy your brand. But we're not talking about that world. The world we live in, there's no one's walking by a shelf. They didn't just run out of your product. You're trying to get them to do something new, generally if they've never done before. So I just don't think brand is builds much advantage, nor is it much of a defense anymore. You need something more powerful.
Like these network effects.
Yes.
Are there other things other than network effects that you like to rely on, or really are we focused on that?
It's not something you like to rely on. There are brief times when if your idea is sufficiently different. Well, actually, let me speak to one source of venture that still does work,
but
they're rare. And that is, I think there's an HBR piece that calls it a multi-factor process advantage.
Mm.
So this is something where you have a method of production that is very different than the rest of the industry and very hard to copy because it differs on so many attributes, such as Southwest Airlines. Yeah. Southwest Airlines has been the best performing U.S. airline for 30 years. And they use their labor different, they use capital different, there are so many differences between how they operate versus a normal airline. And the other airlines are hidebound and union constrained, and so they just can't copy a superior method. So Southwest has retained a fairly durable advantage. The Toyota production system is another. And the Toyota makes cars in the plant in a way that's fundamentally different than the procedures used in normal auto plants.
And famously, they've allowed the other car manufacturers to come into their factories
Absolutely.
And videotape and spend as much time as they want, and they're incapable of copying.
And GM had a Toyota factory in the GM footprint in the United States and had all the data and visited. I learned about this in part from a GM executive who was flying out from Detroit to visit the NUMMI plant that was here in the Bay Area. And the other automakers essentially haven't copied well. And you can see companies like Danaher and Ford who've copied the Toyota production system and reapplied them in their industry. I mean, Danaher has a stock growth track record much better than SAP, on par with Intuit's stock growth since we went public 25 years ago. And yet Danaher works in industrial products and test equipment for factories, not sexy businesses at all. But they've applied this multi-factored process advantage to real advantage.
Mm-hmm.
So that...
We might even look at an Apple or an Amazon. Might be.
I would say Amazon has built a multi-factor process advantage in software development. The speed with which they can move and innovate in a large... It used to be you build a large software company and you get slow and stupid and non-innovative. Amazon's kept speed and innovation, rampant innovation, despite size. So I think there's something going on there special. But those are rare. Few companies...
Correct. That's about culture and about hiring and
yes.
about a real determination
yes.
to do something
right.
different.
And, right, and a real invention of a better way that works that's generally totally against the way the rest of the world works.
Right.
But that's just not going to happen very often.
Yeah, that's right.
But it's powerful, and that, I think, continues to work.
Did Intuit have network effects at the beginning? And does it have network effects now?
Yeah, I would say for all of my work and study of them, we don't have the strength and network effect position that I wish we had. So we were a paradigm difference that allowed us to beat the competitors in the 80s and early 90s. And then we had enough scale that we had some scale advantages. And then in QuickBooks, we have developed a degree of, I'd say, a moderate network effect in that accountants know QuickBooks and prefer it, so they recommend to their clients.
Mm-hmm.
There's more bookkeepers who know QuickBooks,
mm-hmm.
so they recommend to their clients.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier for the client to work with an accountant if you're on QuickBooks because they use QuickBooks. So we would have a moderate network effect advantage, I would qualify that as.
It's almost, it's probably not a protocol network advantage, which is a direct network
Correct.
Advantage, but it's,
Correct.
But it's something like that, which is that there's some sort of standardization
yes.
through the labor pool
yes.
that's taking place.
Pool. Yes, and this has a degree of switching cost, and the switching cost here is the cost to learn a new bookkeeping system. Just like languages have high switching costs, because once you learn a language, it's so much easier to just use that one than learn a new one. This is not on the same scale of difficulty of learning, but once you have learned how a system works like QuickBooks, it's so much easier to keep using it than to have to learn a rival.
Right. So there's that groove in.
Yeah.
And then any new hiring manager is going to be taught by the marketplace that they should just hire a QuickBooks person.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's sort of a two-sided
yeah.
protocol.
So yeah. So we get a degree of what I'd call moderate effect of network effect there.
Got it. And have you tried any others in the business? Have you thought of adding any other, like a platform? I mean, I know that Intuit has a platform.
Yes. We do have a developer platform, again, built around QuickBooks. And I'd say, again, that's moderately, you know, there's more systems that hook into QuickBooks. Thus, QuickBooks, if you adopt it, gives you more data access and interaction that's automated with other systems. So I'd say, again, that's a moderate level. We've tried to make that stronger, and I think maybe we'll discover out how to make that stronger. But I have to say, I want to ask how you first discovered network effects and became aware of them, and then I'll describe it wasn't at Intuit that I discovered the power of network effects. It was elsewhere. So first, how did you get?
Yeah. So we started a company in 99 that did not have network effects, and in the end, we sold it to a company that did have network effects. And when we got over there and saw how bad their management was, and they still had a $7 billion market cap, and this was Monster.com, that the fact that they still had $7 billion market cap and they were running it so poorly, and no matter how they try to screw the company up, it still continued to chug along and produce $1 billion of revenue and be worth so much that they were buying us, not us buying them. It was a real shock to us. And so that was 2004 when we sort of said, whoa, this is a whole different paradigm. This is really durable. You can make all sorts of mistakes. You go to sleep and wake up in the morning and your company's just bigger than it was before, more powerful than it was before. So everything we want to do going forward has got to have these things. And so we started becoming students at that time. And it's taken probably a decade to start to tease out all the different types, because we've heard about Metcalfe's law, and that only relates to direct network effects. But then there are these two-sided network effects, like the one you described that Intuit has with the labor market, or a marketplace, or a platform network effect, or an asymptoting marketplace network effect. There's several of these two-sided network effects that are different from Metcalfe. And there's a whole region around data network effects that just haven't been measured or discussed yet. And so it's taken us all this time to sort of tease all that out. But how about you? When did you first discover these?
It was in the late 90s. I, for some crazy reasons, managed to be on the board of Amazon and eBay at the same time. And eBay was, it just defied explanation. I remember I first came across eBay when they published books of, this is the early days of the web, they published books that showed the amount of traffic and screens per pages per user for thousands of websites. I don't think it was a book, it was online. And I was just perusing to see which websites were getting the most activity and particularly which were getting the heaviest usage. And I was just scrolling down these pages online looking, and most of the pages per visit were in the 2 or 3 range. So people barely used websites back then. And then I ran across a thing called eBay, E-B-A-Y. And then I got an email from Mae Whitman, and she said, hey, Scott, I've just joined this company as CEO of eBay. I'd love to come talk to you about you joining our board. I said, well, I don't know what eBay does, but I really want to learn. So, you know, I found out this amazing thing. They opened up a retail store, Pierre did, and he left it empty. He put nothing on the shelves. And the world came and filled it up with merchandise. Because it was kind of the original two-sided network executed marketplace done in software. And it's just amazing how the thing grew. And then I was, John Doerr and I were skiing in Aspen over Christmas. And Jeff Bezos emailed us saying, hey, I'm in town. I'd like to take you guys to dinner. So we left our families. We had dinner with Jeff. Partway through, he said, Jeff, so why did you invite us to dinner? He said, well, I want you both to know that we have been secretly building our eBay killer.
Mm.
And we didn't want you to know, Scott, because you'd have a conflict with that. But we will launch it on Tuesday. And I'm sure you'll want to, of course, leave the eBay board because, you know, they're going to be toast. So I wanted to give you that heads up.
Nice. Very kind of him.
Yeah. Very, very much. And so I said, well, Jeff, you know, your company, you know how I love what you're doing in Amazon. It's phenomenal. And you have truly vanquished a number of competitors around you. And around you, 359 degrees, you have mediocre companies as potential places, categories you could enter. Except one, we have a company with a powerful network effect. This is not going to end very well. But he was undaunted by my advice. And so then I watched what happened. And it turns out that within a matter of a couple of months, the two most powerful companies in the digital world, which at the time were Yahoo and Amazon, both decided to attack eBay with clones. And they had done excellent clones of eBay. In fact, the software was better. The sites looked better. They were, you know, these companies, eBay at the time looked kind of more like Craigslist.
Mm-hmm.
And these two competitors from had really slick working sites, plus they were being advertised from the most powerful home pages in the business. For several months, Yahoo's homepage, the most powerful page in the world, did nothing but advertise Yahoo auctions. Plus a major pricing advantage. eBay at the time, take rate was around 6% of every transaction. The take rates at Amazon and Yahoo were zero. It was free. So you would think that a free competitor, advertised and delivered by the most powerful entrants in the world, would crush little eBay. But in fact, the reverse happened. They bounced off. Nothing happened. eBay kept growing. Those guys couldn't get traction. Even though they were free, and eBay charged 600 basis points. So, and I said, that got my attention, saying, there's something more powerful than I've ever seen in business. And then you started seeing the, you know, Intel microprocessor, the Microsoft operating system, Word, and Microsoft Office. You started seeing these, all of a sudden the picture came together of, shoot, there's a number of companies that have built some phenomenal competitive advantages where no attempt to disrupt them has had any effect, and where their share positions get closer and closer to 100. This is an effect the world has never seen before. Except in a government-granted monopoly, which is are increasingly rare nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what got my attention. And then I started studying them in earnest.
And that was sort of late 90s, early 50s?
Yeah, 98.
And did you stay on the Amazon board or the eBay board?
Ultimately, I had to choose because the company stayed rivalrous, and I elected to stay on the eBay board.
Mm-hmm. Nice, nice. With the network effect. Now, eventually, Amazon has gotten very large and does have a big marketplace. More than 50% of their transactions are now in their two-sided marketplace. But it just took 20 years.
Yes. They decided to really embrace the two-sided market. The first merchant in the world ever to do that, to really embrace, after having been a merchant where they put the merchandise on the shelf, they embraced the two-sided where other people put merchandise in.
So it was a mental shift that they had to make first. And then when they came at it again in the late 2000s,
but they made it pretty quick.
A little bit.
I mean, the whole move into Amazon auctions was a move there. So Jeff got the Jeff is so smart. Mm-hmm. He got the mind shift early. Mm-hmm. He just had to work. Initially, they couldn't win by going head first into eBay. They had to find a way to work around it.
I see.
Okay.
They had to have a differentiated supply. Yeah. Interesting. So. What was the most surprising thing you've ever learned about network effects? And these are great founding stories.
God, I'm still learning. There's so much. I think most of what we will know, we don't yet know. I'd say the thing that's been surprising is how small the founding teams are of some of the great network effect businesses today. Pierre Omidyar worked alone to write and launched eBay after what he says was a three-day weekend of work. So what's stunning is how tiny the teams were who built and launched the first versions of what became powerful network effects.
Yeah.
That just, wow. The world's never seen something where so few can produce something of such global strength, reach, and strength.
Right. On the backs of this Internet thing that someone else built for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but you can have small teams on the internet that don't amount to much. You can have big teams.
Yeah,
here's that's been the biggest surprise to me.
Yeah, which also speaks to the capital efficiency that you can get from these companies.
Huge,
which implies greater returns for the employees with their stock options, which implies greater returns for the investors.
Absolutely. I mean, Pierre, up to that time, the investment that Benchmark made into eBay was the single best venture investment ever made in world history. But also think of Pierre's thing. He not only did he code it himself, he launched it himself, and he was the only employee for many months.
Mm-hmm.
Only when so many checks came in that he needed help cashing the checks did he finally hire somebody. So remarkable efficiency of both labor and capital.
Yeah. And with these marketplace network effects, these two-sided ones, a lot of people have talked about the Twitter and the Facebook and the WhatsApp. These are direct network effects, where everyone's coming for the same thing. One Twitter account is the same as another. One Facebook account is the same as another. But when I go to an eBay, when I go to to buy something on Craigslist or sell something on Craigslist, those are two different types of people with two different types of experiences.
Yes.
I'd love to dive into a discussion of how some of these two-sided network effects work in more detail, because you've got one going here with Intuit. You've been on the board of eBay a long time, and you got to watch that grow up from the beginning. I think, the one-sided network effect, or the direct network effect, has been sort of overdone, but the two-sided hasn't been nearly as much discussed, and I think that, that might be helpful to people to hear some of your thoughts about how you see those things playing out.
Well, let's exchange thoughts. So one part is that two-sided, they're also N-sided, where there's more than two sides. So the classic one here is the Microsoft OS network effect. So say Microsoft Windows, where you had hardware makers, so makers of PCs, independent software developers, consumers, so people who buy the machines, corporations and consumers, and then you had Microsoft. So they were actually orchestrating three sides.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing the consumer chose then drove the hardware makers, which drove the software, and so they were able to orchestrate a three-way.
Mm-hmm.
Two sides is one part of what could be more complex. So that's the first observation.
Yeah,
it could be
sure.
more than
sure.
Two sides. So what have you learned about two-sided?
The two-sided network effects are more prevalent than three-sided. And, in fact, I think the three-sided are less common than the N-sided, where you might have a market network where there's a whole bunch of different types of people that are
mm-hmm.
inside of an existing offline marketplace that we then digitize through a website and mobile apps. And the three-sided is so difficult to get because they all have such strong independent ideas about what they want out of the marketplace. And typically when you're building these two-sided marketplaces, you basically are building two different companies at the same time. Okay, you have to satisfy the demand and you have to satisfy the supply at the same time in the appropriate volumes so that liquidity is achieved for both sides and people don't defect to someplace else. It's a very difficult plane to fly.
Mm-hmm.
And so flying that with three becomes astronomically even more difficult. And so we've seen very few of these three-sided marketplaces, as you describe, with Microsoft, but there you go. I mean, they've been around since 76, 78, and they're still worth $700 billion. It's very, very durable once you get it, but hard to do. We're now seeing more of these N-sided marketplaces where you could have, let's say, a event planner with a photographer, with a venue, with
a caterer.
And so they can all coordinate and collaborate using the software in ways that they couldn't have done before. And we're seeing that go in the travel industry. We're seeing that in the consulting industries, et cetera, et cetera. Because these are marketplaces where there's lots of independent workers, and obviously Intuit and the software you have services a lot of these SMBs, and they are all in their own small networks that are offline today, and we could help bring them online. So we're seeing that. The other challenge with these two-sided marketplaces again gets back to the issue of liquidity, where if I come and I list an object that I want to sell and it doesn't sell, then I might never come back, or if I come to find something and it's not there, or it's not in the quantities or the prices that I want, then I won't come back. Balancing that and then paying both sides essentially with your equity or with your time to balance those out as you grow has proven really difficult. And so as a result, we've seen a lot of success with companies like OpenTable or Salesforce, who immediately put out a SaaS tool like you've done, right, to put out SaaS for a whole group of users. And then you build up the platform. And then on top of the platform, you can stack other applications, and that builds you a network effect that starts with a SaaS company first. But again, it takes a mental shift to then move into this new network effect type of a business.
All aboard, get on board. All aboard, get on board.
There's a train coming somewhere down the train. The people that ain't ready better step in. This train has been running since time began. It's running on the love of your fellow man. All aboard,
all aboard,
you better get on board. All aboard,
all aboard,
child, you better get on board. People get ready, there's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the diesels humming. You don't need no ticket, you just
thank the Lord.
All aboard, child, you better get on board. All aboard, Lord, you better get on board. People get ready, the train is going to Jordan. It's picking up passengers coast to coast. Faith is the key, it opens the doors for boarding. You don't need no ticket, you just thank the Lord.
I believe,
I truly believe,
believe
that one day the world will be full of love.
I believe,
there ain't no room for the hopeless sinner. One who would hurt all mankind just to save his
own.
We should have pity on those, cause their chances grow thinner. There's no hiding a place amongst the kingdom's throne.
All aboard,
child, you better get on board.
All aboard,
child, you better get on board.
All aboard,
child, you better get on board. The people that ain't ready got to step in. Lord, the train's been running since time began. It's running on the love of your fellow man.
All aboard,
child, you better get on board.
All aboard,
Lord, you better get on board.
All aboard.
الحمد لله رب العالمين وبسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وأشهد أن محمد رسول الله. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. الحمد لله. Thank you for joining us this evening for Wealth Creation and Preservation. الحمد لله. We just played a portion of a recording focused on network effects, which is also the focus of the broadcast today. Before I run on, let me invite you to have any comments or questions that you want to raise, either about what you just heard or anything else that, you know, has bearing on this particular subject matter, which is wealth creation and preservation. Beyond that, we're going to go forward with a menu of information this morning. All others, it's open. Oh, even on Facebook, for the moment, I can see comments before I shut that part of it down, then we're going to go ahead. All right. This is Dante.
As-salamu alaykum, brother Imam.
Alaykum as-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. How's it going?
Life is good. Life is good. It's still in the fight.
It is,
still in
it
the
is.
Game. Not flooded.
All right.
not frustrated at all by what we see.
There you go.
You know, we believe in what's to come, you know, not short sighted.
That's what's up. That's
exactly.
What's up. That's what. There you go. Go ahead. What you got for us?
So I just kind of one comment and one question.
Okay.
Comment, you know, as Muslims, like some of the words that they talked about, durable advantage. And you know that the Quran has been unchanged, untouched, you know, from the beginning. So like relating that, and then the multi-fact, you know, and just thinking about the Quran from that perspective as well, you know, and how dynamic it is and its ability to be in different places, well, have survived in different places throughout the world, change cultures, change you know, monetary systems, just all that it has done, changed societies. So those are two things that I correlated to this topic. And then the last thing, I think I understood the two-sided market and the three-sided market. But when he talked about, did he say inside or end side, E-N-D or I-N-S-I-D-E?
You know, there's the inside. I haven't detailed that aspect of it. But first, he's talking about two-sided, three-sided, and then he's talking about inside. So that all that has to do with, you know, their vision of the kind of markets that they addressed, like, that dimension of it is beyond me for a detail. To understand that, I can work it out, but I don't want to try to work it out live.
Absolutely,
that is very important. You know, it's like again, it's worth listening to again, but. When I first think about the two-sided market, you know, you have the buyers and the sellers. That's like the two-sided, two-sided market. Then, you know, the three-sided is it must be someone who is like logistically connected to the process in some way. You know what I'm saying? They're not really inside. They're not really outside, but they are facilitating that market that they're all a part of. So I'm saying it's there, man. And let me just say, for the benefit of everybody, it's like. Once you know what your question is, I'm like me, for example, your question raised a question for me, and which is really the same question. It's like, okay, what is meant by, you know, a three-sided market? There's an answer for that in layman's terms online somewhere. You just have to go there with it. That is a product of the network effect of Google and its application of AI, right? So. Great question. So, inshallah, you get an answer. You send it to me. All right.
Inshallah. All right. Assalamu
alaikum. Assalamu alaikum. Thanks. Okay. All right. Alhamdulillah. So, let's go on with what we want to do, because the main thing that I'm interested in is for us to really understand the nature of the network effect. And as Dante says, like, you know, I'm not worried, I'm not anxious, I'm, you know, hey, still in the game, et cetera, with no, you know, thinking about getting out. But I know that even though, you know, Bitcoin, for example, you know, right now it's like 34,600 round figures. And, you know, and that's quote unquote up, but then it's also down from, high of a month ago, you know, alhamdulillah, but hey, that's a part of, that's the nature of the asset that we're dealing with. And so it's very important to me that you, whoever is listening, that you have a foundation for conviction. That's what I want. I want you to have a foundation for conviction. You know, it's like Abraham in the fire. Even though we're talking about an asset that's $35,000, you know, if you got any part of that asset and you $35,000, it's like you would have had to bought it at more than $35,000 for you to not be in profit right now. And, you know, I just have a tendency to think that most of you did not. If you did buy in, you didn't buy in at $35,000 and above. But I don't know. So, but the point is that even that, it's like you're still in profit. But I guess it's just the point of seeing where it was and then seeing where it is. But then if you really understand the asset itself, then you understand that that's the nature of it right now. It's the volatility is a part of the program right now. It's still growing. That's a part of the whole process. But let me dial it back to the very important point that Dante was making with regard to relating it to the Quran and the idea of durable advantage. Absolutely, positively, that is it. And the Quran and Al-Islam itself is the most powerful network effect when we just think about it that way. I don't know if I have the definition of network effect right in front of me. Network effect, yeah, it says network effect is a phenomenon whereby increased numbers of people or participants improve the value of a good or a service. The adoption of the internet is an example of that. So, you know, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, nafsun wahida, one person, right? And then more people joined his network, you know, his network expanded until now, you know, one fifth of the planet Earth are Muslims. So the network effect of Al-Islam and the Quran is fixed. It's like, it's not going to be removed. It is forever to the end. Yes, it is forever. The Quran is like the blockchain. The Quran is like the blockchain. And for everything, you look at blockchain, look at what blockchain brings to, you know, the economic space and brings to the whole idea about transparency and against fraud and counterfeiting and all of those kinds of things. Quran does that, right? The Quran is put together, let me reverse the semantics. The blockchain is put together like the Quran is put together, right? What do you mean? It means that whenever something comes in, we're going to make an ayah, a transaction. The ayah is a transaction. When that transaction comes in, it's broadcast to everybody. It's broadcast to everybody. Iqra bismi rabbika alladhi khalaq. It's broadcast to everybody. Everybody hears it. Everybody gets it. Everybody is taught to memorize it. Everybody, you know, and you are, there are certain instances where you're supposed to say it out loud and in public so that everybody can hear what's being said. And if you make a mistake, then you will be corrected from the body who is there. Well, that's the blockchain. And when a revelation came to the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, then the angel Jibril would tell him where to put it. And that is where it will be, and that's where it is forever. Can't be changed, can't be counterfeited, can't be edited, done. The Quran is, that is, blockchain is like the Quran. See, that's also a reason to have confidence in it, because it's like the Quran. Now, if you want to run from that, mashallah, alhamdulillah, rabbil alamin, it's okay. You got to do, you know, everybody has a different risk profile. But I'm saying the very analogy that the Quran has with that asset, that tool, should give us confidence in the tool, okay? It's like if I listen to somebody, I listen to a scholar, and he says something, and he says a number of things that are like what Imam Muhammad said, or I'm going to pay a lot of attention to that. I don't mean non-Muslim, you know, okay, Christian, Jew, whatever, male, female, if they say, when they say, what is, what's that, you got a question? My grandson is with me. You're about to leave? All right, Father, come put your face on here and let people see my handsome grandson. Stick your head over. Say, As-salamu alaykum. What's your name?
Jacob.
Tell me the first Arabic alphabet that you know.
F.
What's the rest of them? That's enough for now. I'm hitting you spontaneously. Thank you. Travel safe. Make dua for your grandpa, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Love you. As-salamu alaykum. Pull the door tight when you go, okay? All right, see you next time. All right, so in terms of, where were we at? Blockchain. So in terms of blockchain, what the Quran is, confidence,
should come because of the parity, not the parity so much, the comparison, the attributes and qualities that the blockchain has. I mean, it's very, you know, I counted in the Sunnah of Allah. I counted in the Sunnah of Allah. It's Allah solving a major problem for humanity in this period of time, and we're blessed to be alive at this period of time when that comes into the world, and you're in an early position to do that. But let's stop editorializing. Let's go on with some content around this. All right. So that's there. I mean, that and many other reasons are reasons for having confidence in the blockchain is the thing. Let's just put it like this: the blockchain is the thing. All right. Bitcoin is the first of those quote cryptocurrencies coming off the blockchain. And I'm not going to go into it. You should be studying. You should already have some idea about it right now. I will, because it is right now. It's existing. It's not going away. Allahu alam. It's not going away. So the point now is, in the midst of all this volatility and in the midst of this price that it is right now relative to us, that's still high, about $34,000. That's more than a car that most of us would be thinking about buying. And again, you don't have to buy a whole Bitcoin to get involved. But I'm just saying, when it's talked about as a, you know, as its whole, as a unit price. And so that unit, that's $35,000. And your automatic reaction is like, man, I ain't got no $35,000. You know, or if you do have $35,000, shoot, that's almost all my retirement money, whatever. So what I'm saying is, I'll just continue to say what I'm going to say, and then you just do what you're going to do. So we're talking about network effects mainly, but let me continue to just mention a couple of things. At the end of his interview, he said several things. He talked about how surprised he was about how few people could do so much. It's like the power of the mind of an individual, because that's what's happening. These developers, these coders, or whatever, these app makers, whatever you want to call them, whatever their proper name is. Very few, and they are making the things that are of the greatest effect historically. There's something in his language that says, like, they created something that has the greatest effect of any technology in history, something on that language, right? And you're talking about two or three, a very small number of people. And that also brought my attention immediately to the Quran, where the Quran says, how often has God by a small force vanquished a large force? And this is, it's that kind of knowledge, a certain type of knowledge, whatever it might be during any given period of time, a certain type of knowledge gives the possessor of that knowledge leverage in creation. It gives the possessor of that knowledge leverage in creation. They can do things. They can exert a force that is outsized by comparison to how many people are exerting that force, right? You know, you and I with a jack, you know, you can lift the car. You can lift the car with a jack. You have one arm. You don't have to use two hands. You just one arm. Lifting a car up, right? That's leverage, right? Okay, certain knowledge gives the human being certain leverage. And so this kind of knowledge, this kind of technology, this kind of everything we're talking about the computer apps. We're really talking about computer applications. We're talking about algorithms. We're talking about those kinds of things. But what they are also a language. It's a big story in that. It's another kind of language, and it's language that really has the power. And language has everything to do with thinking abstractly. Let me see if you can grasp this picture real quick, because I want us to appreciate that the people that we're talking about and the people that we're listening to and the people that are making the billions, even trillions of dollars in cash flow, they are doing what I'm talking about. They're doing what I'm talking about
because they're in the domain where they have the wherewithal to extend themselves in that way. So language, so there's computer language, right? There's all different kinds, but fundamentally human language. Okay, then computer language is another kind of language. People talk about language, I don't know, whatever it might be, C++, or I'm talking about, oh, I'm thinking the last hour, I'm really thinking about, yeah, Fortran, and I never got into learning computer languages because that's what they use to write the apps and the codes and what have you to make these Bitcoins and Ethereums and other things. It's people who know computer language, right? All right. So but what is computer language using? Computer language is using math and certain other aspects of creation, right? You talk about zeros and ones, you know, binary codes, blah, blah. All these are abstracts. These are abstracts that you know, show up in the signs of numbers. But these numbers have the impact of moving machinery in a certain way. When you talk about opening, closing gates and on and off switches inside of a computer system, blah, 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 translating letters into numbers and numbers into, you know, functions. Okay, I'm telling you that much just so, and there's someone on here knows the real details of what I'm talking about. But the point is that in essence is what it is. And so once you learn, okay, Spanish, right? Spanish. You learn how to speak Spanish. Then, now I'm talking about a non-Spanish speaking person who has a certain skill set, and then they also learn also how to speak Spanish or French or German or Italian or some other language, then they can go into that world with that language, and depending on how sophisticated their level of knowing and fluency is in that language, they can move things in that world. They can move things in that world, right? Same way with computer language. When you understand that language, then you can move more things because of the language, because computer language and what can be done with computers by virtue of the language that you understand, i.e. the apps that you create, the algorithms, et cetera. Okay, that's what these people are doing, right? And so, I guess I'm just eager to get to this point. I'm just going to say this. Listen, I've talked to you about abstract composites, right? Abstract, just think physically, literally just beyond the sky, right? Just beyond the sky. Imagine that beyond the sky, there's a whole world of signs, symbols, rules, laws, et cetera, that are beyond the skies. And they're all abstract, and the only way that they can be reached is not by going there physically. The only way they can be reached is by being thought of. So thought is the vehicle, right? So imagine thought to be a rocket. Thought is the rocket. And so you get in that rocket, and then that rocket takes you beyond the skies and takes you into a realm where all these abstract composites exist. That is, you have the math, you have the rules and laws and principles that are at work, whatever laws of thermodynamics and this and that and that, which are themselves invisible. They're not concrete, but they are real in what they're able to impact. And so someone who goes up there grasps those concepts, and then they come back to Earth, right? Thought is the vehicle. Then they come back to Earth, and then they apply it on Earth, and they change things on the Earth on the basis of what they went up there and got on the vehicle of thought, abstract thinking, abstracted from the abstract composites, the particular information, brought it back with them, and with the understanding of how to apply it on the Earth, they change things on the Earth, right? Okay, well, that's what's happening with everything. Automobiles, that's what happened. Airplanes, that's what happened. Computers and typewriters and everything.
sawmills and steam engines. And where did they come from? They came from thought, grasping the abstract, bringing it down, making it concrete, and changing the world. Okay, by virtue of that application. All right. You can hear it in the word application. By that application of what? Application of that abstract composite. How? After you put it into a form that it can be applied in three-dimensional space. And so we get automobiles, we get rockets, we get satellites, we get computers, we get cell phones. These are all products of abstract thought, which is possible because of language. Different language, you can do different things. Computer language, you can do things that computers do. Artificial intelligence, you can do the thing, that's Google. You can do the things that Google does because of the grasp of the concept of artificial intelligence and how to make it operate in a machine-like way. Okay, that's what has been done with cryptocurrency. Cryptocurrency is the new airplane, the new car, the new whatever you want to think about. It's that new thing. But it is about transaction of value, the transfer of value. All right. Maybe I didn't stop a little bit more. Okay. Oh, another thing, the person, during the interview, the person said what surprised him so much is that he spoke about one of the apps, one of the powerful, whatever, something that we take for granted right now. But this guy, he was all alone. He was the only one that did it. He created the app. He created the whatever the tool, whatever the utility was, and put it to use. And he was alone. He didn't have anybody else working with him. And for a long time, he had nobody else working with him. And the leverage that was for as far as wealth creation was for him was such that the checks kept coming, the money kept coming. There was so much money. He was forced to hire somebody to help him cash the checks. That was like, there's just so much coming in. I can't even cash the checks that I'm generating, right? So he was forced to hire somebody, and that made me think also about the Quran. Well, the Quran speaks about Qarun, and it says that the keys of his treasures would be a burden for a body of men. That's Allah's eloquence. The keys to his treasure would be a burden for a body of men. That's what that man was experiencing. He said, I can't even cash these checks by myself. So, but I'm saying that this asset at this time is offering that as an opportunity. It's like it's better than democratic, but I'll use that word. The democratic opportunity, free and open opportunity for all of us to earn that kind of wealth. That's what Allah has allowed to come into three-dimensional space right now. That's what Allah has allowed to come into three-dimensional space right now. A universal opportunity for all human beings who would take advantage of it to become as wealthy as they can imagine. But I say again, back to the Quran, do you think that you're going to be left alone on saying we believe and not be tried? You think you're going to enter paradise just by saying we believe and not be tried? So you got to be able to hang on through this volatility. You got to be able to hang on through people saying, oh, it's not going to work. Look what Elon Musk is doing. Oh, look, yeah, first it was here. Look where it is now. Oh, it's going down. Okay, alhamdulillah, So, That's what you have to have in mind, right? So even like Litecoin is a coin that this guy, I think his name is Charlie Lee or whatever. It's like he just did it because of the fact that okay, it can be done. I can do this. It's sort of like let me just try this. Let me do something. Let me see if this app works.
let me see if this. He had enough knowledge to be able to take the white paper and take the blockchain technology, et cetera, and create. That's what the blockchain affords, right? It affords you the opportunity to create a coin, even the whole Dogecoin thing. What I'm saying, but you know, I'm not looking at the price. I don't keep that Litecoin as one of my. It's not in my bag. But the point is that it's worth hundreds of millions of dollars now, if not some billions. No doubt, it's probably billions. Let me see. Since I said that. Where we at? See, I just want to see. You go to CoinMarketCap when you do that. That's just for, let that be a bit of instruction. Okay, so Litecoin, it's dropped out. It's not in the top 10. It used to be a long time in the top 10. But this is one man's creation. Lite is one of those coins made from that app, that white paper, et cetera. Litecoin. It's market cap, meaning that this is how much its value is as a market. $9 billion, round figures, $9,500,000,000. $9 billion. But who did that? Charlie Lee, one guy, right? So, and I think there's another one. Let me go ahead and look at it, because it started the same way. And they didn't get any special permission from anybody to do this. This thing called Yearn Finance. It's a coin that's 31,752. Basically, the image when you get the story of how this started, it's a guy sitting on his bed in his pajamas, and he made this app, The market cap for it, $1,165,000,000. Who did that? One guy, right? And then when you go to Ethereum, which I can't even say his name, Buterin, most of you know. let me get back on that. Where are we going here? Ethereum, which is that number two, right? Ethereum. It's not one guy, and I think he was 19 years old when he first wrote the app. Right? It's down now by like 50% off of its high. Also, but $247 billion. That's what he did. $247 billion. Right? So, who, done by who? Not these people are not people that are authorized by the government, or they were promoted through certain institutions, Yale, Harvard, Princeton, whatever. No, these are individuals who got their hands on the code, which was published to the public, and went to work utilizing it for what it could do, right? And those of us who are trying to benefit from it, who are benefiting from it right now, it's like, we're benefiting from the work that they did. So they're on the front end, and they get that truly, truly world-changing wealth. But the point is that it's because they had the intellect to grasp what the abstract nature of the work, the concrete nature of the work, the mathematical reality, the computer language related to it. They knew that, and then they went ahead and did it, right? This person talked about SaaS tools. That's something worth looking up. But I won't try to explain it right now, but I will say this. I've spoken to you about Ethereum, so I want you, okay, what's the big deal about Ethereum? One of the big deals, ways of understanding Ethereum, what is it and why should there be any confidence in it at all? What aspect of it is, Ethereum is like plastic or lumber. I'm just saying metaphorically so as to understand. If you don't like plastic, then think in terms of lumber, right? But when you talk about plastic, it's like it's probably any number of 100 things in your environment right now that are made of plastic, right? They're made of plastic. So plastic. So imagine plastic as just this long, whatever, flat plane of material, and then someone decides to take it, and not just a flat plane of material, make it liquid too. It's liquid. So it's moldable, it's malleable, it's shapeable, et cetera. And so you decide, okay, well, I can do this with that, and I can do that with this, and I can do this with that, right? So, you know, whatever, picnic. You know, you have plates, forks, spoons, knives, cups, bowls, whatever. All these things, right? They're made of plastic, right? Well, Ethereum does that for the transaction space. So when you talk about smart contracts and the like, so the plastic is, it's up to you. You decide what mold you want to put it in, and if you make something useful out of the plastic, then people buy it and use it. Maybe you want to make a fan. You want to make a fan out of it, you know? Okay, good. That's you. That's what you want to do. What do you do? We have the plastic. So the Ethereum is the foundation for these different smart contracts and other things that are being made. So it's like, that's where, so its value gets built up because the more people use it, because of that particular utility, its ability to be used as a support layer for a smart contract or anything else that a person is thinking about in a financial space, then it's free. So it's, go ahead, do your thing. And so, but Ethereum benefits because, of course, in order for it to be mined, et cetera, you have to pay somebody to do that and all the rest of that. All right. Okay, so, all right, so that's fundamental stuff. So let's say, why will Bitcoin and cryptocurrency ultimately be adopted and displace the fiat currency system as the main transaction tool? This is what we're speaking about, the future. It's happening right now, but what is happening right now is nowhere near what it will be. Actually, in a very few short years, Allahu Alam, we always have to say, inshallah, but by all indications, it's like, it's just something that's just incredibly mind-boggling from where we stand right now, from the paradigms that we've been raised in. But let's shift this paradigm, right? Paradigm shifts, they are a product of problem and solutions. That is, paradigms shift because a problem that seems to be ongoing, sooner or later somebody starts saying, we got to fix this. And other people say, okay, well, you go and work on it right now. I'm going to keep using what we're using right now. So there are people who use the old system with all of its problems, with all of its shortcomings, while somebody else is on the side saying, it's got to be a better way. And so then that person exerts themselves to solve the problem that's inherent in the existing paradigm. And then when they come up with that aha moment and the solution to the problems that are inherent with the old paradigm, then the paradigm shifts. Not immediately, but the paradigm shifts because, hey, I got a solution to that problem, right? Let's go with the wheel or what have you. It's like there are many problems that the wheel solved for those who didn't have wheels, and there's many problems that the ability to control and manage and produce fire that it solved, that problems that were being had in the absence of this capacity. All right, well, that's how it is with everything. Everything, transportation, communication, protection, warfare, whatever, is all of those things. They are all just paradigm shifts. Okay, so we are in the midst of the most major paradigm shift for wealth since the decision to use gold and silver as money. That's how big the change right now is. And the very fact that Bitcoin, as an example, is the top contender to gold as that ultimate champion representing store of value, trustworthiness, and blah, 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 it's like Bitcoin's like, is basically telling gold you're properly relieved. Right? But let's go on, because the whole issue of paradigm shift is what we have to understand. So as a new technology, we should add, there's an important relationship between the adoption cycle and paradigm shifts. Now, these are two big things that you have to have in your mind right now. I think one of the biggest things about adoption cycles that you should have in your mind right now is have an idea about where we are in the adoption cycle of this new technology that I'm speaking of, blockchain, Bitcoin, cryptocurrency. Put them all in a bag right now. So there's this like normal kind of curve, you know the hump in the middle kind of thing, and so that's the adoption cycle. So certain things have to happen inside that adoption cycle. I won't jump to it right now, but the point is, let it be understood that we are at the early, even with the $35,000 price tag, which is down 50% from its last high, the 65,000, we are still at the early part, the climb of the adoption cycle. When it gets up there to those peaks, it's like we don't have numbers to say what it is. We just don't, because what will be happening within that adoption, what's going to be happening is that Bitcoin, blockchain, cryptocurrency, because they're all together, it's going to be consuming. It's like a fire consuming whole domains of finance, whole worlds of finance, banking, real estate, contracts, everything. And that consumption is reflected in utilization. And that utilization is what expands the network. And the expansion of the network is what grows the value of what is the heart and the nature and the blood, if you will, of that system, which is going to be blockchain, Bitcoin, and other cryptocurrencies. That's what's being changed. The whole world is being changed right now. And we're at the very beginning of the adoption cycle of a major paradigm shift, which is it's flipping the world. You talk about polar shifts. You have that language, polar shifts. Well, that's what's going on. And the wealth that's being garnered right now, and then also wealth that's being transferred right now, is going to last. Like Allahu Alam, you know, inshallah, that's all of that. That's true. It's always true. But at the same time, Allah still leaves us with a level of confidence that okay, yeah. Because if you can see it, inshallah, and Allah is the one who knows, if you can see the sunnah of Allah in it, well, then you take the privilege, you take the precept that Allah says, it says, this is the sunnah of Allah, and never will you find a change in the sunnah of Allah. If you see something happening, Allah is the one who creates and then repeats, right? So if you see something happening and it fits the pattern of what has happened before, and you see the will of God in it, and Allah knows best, you see the will of God in it, then so it's like, that's what's going to happen. That's why we use the Abu Bakr story about Surah Ar-Rum. You have to go back and read it, listen to it yourself. The idea is like it was a sure thing. It was a sure thing if Abu Bakr had stuck with what Allah had actually revealed and not allowed himself to be confined by the unbelievers to put a specific number to Bidr, the specific number. That's where he fell off, literally, figuratively. So the point is that once God has shown you, here's the sign, and the sign is designating this, and the sign is saying this. If you believe in the sign, then, you know, mashallah, it's like it is what it is. You trust that. But again, that has to do with how much you know. Let me move on, see if I can increase your knowledge at the level, give you a sense of, okay, why he's so confident. This is one part of it. When you understand the nature of adoption cycles and when you understand the nature of paradigm shifts, it's like, okay, this is a paradigm shift that's taking place, and we're at the beginning of the adoption cycle for blockchain, Bitcoin, cryptocurrency for the change of the entire global financial system. Get this straight here, brother and sister. If you haven't, if you never looked at that book, and this, you can get it all, most everything you can get on YouTube now. So if you don't feel like flipping pages or what have you, electronically or otherwise, just look at whatever, The Creature from Jekyll Island or something like that. Look that up. But short version is the Bretton Woods system, the fiat currency system that came into place, late 50s, what have you, maybe a little bit before World War II, but basically late 50s, formally speaking. And that became the Bretton Woods system, right? So that when King Dollar was born after World War II, blah, blah, blah. Then that lasted for less than 25 years. I'll just make it quick. That lasted for less than 25 years when in 1971, Richard Nixon cut the American dollar off from the gold standard that they promised at Bretton Woods. You know, all your dollars always going to be backed by gold. Always going to be backed by gold. Okay. Then we go to war in Vietnam, spend a bunch of money, and everybody looking and saying, hey, where is Cat getting all this money to spend for this war? We know who Britain and France is like. We know what it takes to fight that particular war right there. That's why we have to get the hell up out of there. Now, America's up in there and they're fighting. It's like, okay, well, we got to check and see if they still got that gold. So Charles de Gaulle sent a whole battleship over there. He said, hey, look, that's his briefcase. His briefcase was a ship. Yeah, I want my gold. Richard Nixon said, nah, we ain't paying that, man. And the rest is history. And so everybody else in the world said, well, hell, if he ain't got to pay, then we ain't going to pay either. So now we've been on a global fiat currency system backed by nothing but the government and the gun that it's holding, and say that's money. So that's your money, the Federal Reserve. Now, oh, I don't want it. Well, what? That's your money. Oh, well, let me get something different than this. Okay, I can give you some more, but all it's going to be is the fungible paper that I gave you. Just go, you will give me a 20, I'll give you 4 fives. They're going to still be the same thing. Let's move on. So the idea is that this world has been on the fiat currency system since 1971. I want you to understand this is a short period of time. The whole attempt to have the dollar-backed currency, that was born and it lived for a short period of time. Here comes the fiat currency, and it, 1971 up to, let's take it all the way up to 2008. 2008, the world almost, you know, how do you say, crumbled to dust because of the global financial crisis, right, 2008. So how far is that from 71, right? 71, 29 plus 9 months, that's 37 years, less than a lifetime, right? That's 37 years. And now, and it's in that moment that the blockchain Bitcoin was born. In that moment, all of the shortcomings, failures became evident, and the vulnerability and the problems of the fiat, fractional reserve, Federal Reserve, central bank system. Yeah, that was what was born. The Creature from Jekyll Island, that was the turn of the, more than the turn of the 20th century, 1913, something like that. All right, then World War I, World War II, Bretton Woods, closing the gold window, 2008, that gets us to where the birth of Bitcoin cryptocurrency. The merciful Lord, cherisher and sustainer of all the worlds. He said, this is what, because we'd have to talk about debt slavery and all the other kinds of things to really appreciate. This is a part of Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim. Allah cares for all. And he needs to free the world. He chose to. God don't need to do nothing. But he chose to free the masses of the world, many of whom, billions, are unbanked. So they were outside of an economic system itself. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala allowed to come into the world. A
system of access. Some of those countries with the worst governments and the worst economic systems are the ones that are benefiting most from Bitcoin right now, today. Argentina, Venezuela, Nigeria, and so many others. So many are right now in those other countries that have these failing financial systems. What is that? That's the grace of Allah. That's the grace of Allah. These governments can't solve the problem themselves. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he solved it. Here, get this. Cell phones everywhere. You can do it all on the cell phone, and it's money, right? So, okay. So, see, we're over here in America where it's like, we don't need no Bitcoin. Yeah, we got dollars. Look at Wall Street. Hello? She's going to have to hurry up and recognize that the emperor has no clothes. Come on. Come on. The emperor has no clothes. But if you're used to consuming from his media, then it's Big Brother, you know, it's the Wizard of Oz, and you're still operating under the illusion. You're still appropriately asleep, still appropriately in the consensus trance. This is not financial advice. Whatever you do, that's your business. But is that it is not in the interest of those who have benefited most, especially at the top of the food chain when it comes to the fiat currency system. It is not in their larger interest to allow that paradigm to be shifted and then they be set aside. That's why much of the work that's being done right now in the background is designed to get more and more and more of what has already been mined of Bitcoin into the hands of those power elite right now, while scaring people off and FUDing and FOMOing people in and then scaring them off. That's one of the ways that we talked about the pump and dump, the big boy game. So that's it. So let's move. All right. So that's the nature of where we are. So as a new technology, we have to understand the problem that Bitcoin and cryptocurrency solves. That's part of what we talked about. And one of the main things that it solves is the idea of the elimination of fraud, the corruption and the manipulation of the system, the system that is subject to manipulation, the system that is subject to fraud, the system that is subject to the power of corruption. These people who want to push us away from it, they talk about black market, money laundering, whatever, child pornography, drugs. Okay. How would they get that stuff in 2007? Let's just work with that. How would they get that stuff in 2007? Right? And by comparison, in terms of the global market and all these things that you talk about, how much of it was done in Bitcoin and how much it was done in dollars? You know, so much for that. So that's all that's FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt that they're trying to stay away. Boosh, you don't want to do this. You know, that's their idea. Okay, the paradigm shift occurs anytime an established process can be replaced by another better, faster, or cheaper process. That's anytime. Paradigm shift for automobiles, paradigm shift for whatever, travel, paradigm shift for anything, payment systems, paradigm shift for cutting your lawn, paradigm shift for slicing your bread, paradigm shift for trapping mice. You get what I'm saying. So it's like every time somebody comes up with a new way of doing things, build a better mousetrap and the world will be the path to your door. All that is a statement about the nature of invention, of creation, of evolution, paradigm shifts. That's it. So we are at a point now where the paradigm shift that is happening in the financial system of the world, not just the United States. The world's global, because it's been all these central banks, G7, G8, G20, whatever they are, they are a networked, you know, World Bank, IMF, et cetera. That was a part of that Bretton Woods thing. They've been a global network financially So the People's Bank of China, the Bank of England, the Federal Reserve, and whoever else, is like, they're a team. They're a team. And everybody's doing the same thing. Oh, what they're trying to do is just work out the arrangements they have. Yeah, just like the Godfather, you know, when the capitals meet, I'm thinking about the movies, of course. When the capital meet, you know, everybody knows, hey, look, you control the wharf, we control, you know, downtown, you control the garment district, you know, yeah, that's fine. Okay, you got the drugs, you got the girls, you got the gambling. Okay, that's fine. We're good? All right, see you next year. All right, so the idea is that the globe is under the same world, the World Bank. So the world has been under this fiat currency system, and the representatives of the global financial system are the central banks wherever they are, and they communicate with each other to maintain the global fiat currency system. With the birth of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency and blockchain, that's the sun rising on a new world and setting on their world. That's what we're talking about. And everything that's being done to restrict the growth of it is effort to hold back the ultimate triumph of it. That's it. So what are some of the smaller things in the nature of this time that we have seen actually happen? And I want you to understand that just like it has happened in these other things that we're about to mention, which you really know well, that's what's going to happen to the global financial system. So the global finance is one thing. The global financial system is one thing. It's not a lot of things. It's one thing. It's the global financial system. Based on what? Central banking. Based on what? Fiat currency. It. The whole world. Now, when that changes, then the whole world of finance changes. So what has already changed in the nature of this kind of thing? How about Amazon? Amazon became what? An alternative to bricks and mortar retail stores. Bricks and mortar, pre-COVID, et cetera, you can go, there's a Macy's not far from where I live, you go in there, man, it's like, you can hear the crickets. And this is before COVID. It's like, man, this gigantic, humongous store and hardly a soul in it before COVID. Right? What? Amazon's eating their lunch. Same way. So the bricks and mortar, that relates to that, right? How about Uber and Lyft? Uber and Lyft changed the whole transportation industry. So what did Uber and Lyft do to taxis? Are there still taxis? Of course, there's still taxis. You got people saying that. So I'm not going to get in a car with a stranger. I don't know what that means. I mean, because when you get in a taxi, do what you're going to do. But when you get in a taxi, you don't know that guy no more than you know the one that's driving their personal car. If it is their personal car. So the point is that Uber and Lyft is a paradigm shift for taxis. Exactly. How about Airbnb? Airbnb, paradigm shift for hotels. I mean, it's like, you know, the hotels weren't happy to see and are not happy to see Airbnb, et cetera. I'm sure there have been some legal challenges if there aren't any still continuing to try to whatever license limit, blah, 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 whatever. But Airbnb ain't stopping for nobody right now. It's like, that's what's going on. Who is it impacting? Hotels, right? So the hotel industry is impacted by Airbnb. The taxi transportation industry is impacted by Uber and Lyft. The bricks and mortar retail stores impacted by Amazon in a major way, right? And so, and how well have those paradigm shifts been held back? They haven't been held back well at all. Effectively speaking, do other things continue to exist? Yeah, we still have hotels, we still have taxis, and we still have some brick and mortar operations. But are they in the main, are they more lucrative overall than the new kids on the block, if you will? It's like, no, that's it. That reminds me of a piece that we played from Imam last week. And he said, nobody was talking about block before I started talking about block. He started talking about block, right? And so naturally my mind went immediately to blockchain. So the man was already talking about the block, right? and the blocks and the blockchain. Now that comes, some say, is supported with that language, his spirit, his intuition, an extension of that very thing, again giving me more confidence in, yeah, the blockchain, there's things that were already in the atmosphere. All right, so network effects. So these things, Amazon, Uber, Airbnb, just as examples, they are examples of the power of the network effect. They are examples of the power of the network effect. What's the network effect? The network effect effectively is reaching a tipping point. When something reaches a tipping point, it's like it's done. It's over. There's no going back. It's done. Until and unless there is some major paradigm shift for it, right? Like taxis, right? Let's go with taxis. So there was a time where that was a brand new thing to somebody, you know. What is a taxi? You know, just think about the first one is that. You know, I'm gonna start having people pay me to give them rides. So at some level it was new, right? But people, you know, some people adapted it, some people didn't adapt it. But then ultimately it became, okay, it's just a thing. It's what we do, right? But it was a point where it was new. But then it reached a point where it's like it's normal. It's like, okay, taxis. So we taxi, you know, that's what's going on. Airbnb, same thing, and the like. Okay, so they achieve their network effects and more and more and more industry around it, utilization of it, network effect allows that thing to take on a life of its own and also become gravity for whatever domain it's in. Let's move on. So the network effect is a phenomenon whereby increased numbers of people or participants improve the value of a good or a service, right? So when you talk about Bitcoin, you talk about cryptocurrency, we talk about the blockchain, these network effects have been realized. It's like they have reached that tipping point. They're going when Bitcoin reaches $1 trillion, sort of like that's pretty much done. So in the same way, the point, but how so? How did it occur? More and more people began to engage it. When more people began to engage it, that increased the network effect. The N, that variable of numbers of people in the system, increased, and then the gravity of it and the strength of it grows proportionally to the people who adopt it. So there had to be a network effect arrived at when the transformation or the transition or the paradigm shift from candles to electricity, from automobiles, from horses to automobiles, you know, from the television to the internet, from the telegraph to the telephone, and from the Pony Express to the telegraph. There had to be more adoption with the movement from coal to oil. And so many other examples, they achieved this network effect and people stopped using the latter and started using the former, right? Stop using candles, start using electricity, stop using horses, start using automobiles, stop using television as much as they did the internet, stop using telegraph as much as they did telephone, et cetera. Stop using coal as much as they started using oil and the like. Okay, those are all network effects, right? Okay, so that has to do with the adoption cycle. Each one of these had an adoption cycle, right? And finally coming to the point where that tipping point was realized. And so it's nothing controversial about it. But all of these things had their controversies when they started out because they were the new kid on the block. They were the new paradigm. Okay, that's what it is right now for blockchain, Bitcoin, and cryptocurrency. But when you look at those things that came before it, that follow that pattern, that sunnah, I'll say, that sunnah of Allah, I'll say, like, that's what happens. Okay, first there was this thing, and there here comes the new thing, and more it was adopted, and as it was adopted, it increased its network effect, which made its sustainability more permanent and the gravity to it stronger. And therefore, we have more electricity than candles. We have more cars than horses. We have more internet activity and engagement than television, blah, blah, blah. All right, well, that's what's happening with the money system right now. And you need to, inshallah, Allahu A'lam, the decision is yours. But the idea is you got to stop looking at what it is right now. You got to stop looking at what it, whether you're looking at it right now in comparison to what it was a month ago, or whether you're looking at it right now in comparison to what you, quote unquote, know about it or believe that it's going to be, et cetera. And think about it much more futuristically. And ask yourself, how many candles were in the world before we started depending on electricity? How long did it take? You can look these things up. How long did it take a full network of grid of electricity to be established in this country? And then what was the cost of electricity at that time? It was the cost of electricity now. And who is benefiting and being enriched by, who was being enriched by electricity was just gets you got to talk about GE, Westinghouse, and the various. In fact, I think there's a movie about that whole battle of Thomas Edison and Tesla or somebody. Either way, so they give you the backstory on all this electricity that we take for granted right now. It wasn't taken for granted when it was first being started. There was blood in the streets related to this transition and the competition for the transition. Okay, well, what was the electricity? What was its first cost? How many people did it benefit? And what does it cost now? And how many people are being benefited by electricity? Okay, you have to think about cryptocurrency in that way. You look at what you're thinking about what it is right now. Okay, well, you do the math, do some projections, and say, okay, well, what is it going to be? How long from now? Etc. And these are the kind of things you can work these things out. People have already worked them out. There are articles. What I'm talking about, there are articles that are written about all these kinds of things. Which is to say, then you start doing the math and you're looking at something, take some cryptocurrency now that you can get your hands on for 0.0003 cents. So that's ten thousand. So you can get it for 0.003 cents. For 0.003 cents. But if you can get to that place, and you can, if you take the time to look at this thing, because there is something that right now, cryptocurrency, somebody did that app, that guy or that woman or whoever said they wrote this app and this is what this app is supposed to do, blah, 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 but it hasn't been adapted yet because people don't know about it. They're used to using whatever. Okay, but this is its future right here. So electricity, it had a birth like that. Electricity, that, okay, this is what this is. Oh, that's dangerous. It's like, oh, shoot, this will kill you. Whatever, I'll stick with my candles. Okay, alhamdulillah. So the transition cost is also what upholds the old paradigm. People sticking with, oh, I'm familiar with that. I don't know how that works. That might kill me. Give me a candle. That's fine. Alhamdulillah. Okay, well, it's the same way financially speaking, because there are things that are being created right now designed to displace those systems that exist inside of the current legacy financial system that said this is going to replace that, right? And as it is with the world in the past, get out of here, right? But that thing that is 0.0003 cents right now, a situation will arise. It has already arisen for many of things, because Bitcoin is an example. There was a point where Bitcoin was worth nada, nothing, right? And what is it worth now, right? What is its price now? So that's what's happening with these thousands, with many of the thousands of cryptocurrencies right now. It's like, and so you can own, just imagine owning GE stock when it first went public. Just imagine that. You bought some GE stock when it first went public, somehow back in the day after candles, right? Okay, and what is it worth now? It's like, and that's a long time, right? But the way that adoption happens now, because of the nature of communications and all the other infrastructure that are in place, what we're talking about right now, next year, that 0.0003 cent thing, it could be worth $3. Let's just put it like that. It could be worth $3. But what does that mean, is being worth $3? It's worth 10,000 times more, and there's already things that this has happened for in cryptocurrency. It's going to be worth 10,000 times more than what it was then. Okay, so what if you own 10,000 of those 0.0003-cent things, and you said, well, give me 10,000, 10,000 of them, okay? And what did that 10,000 cost you? I think it cost you, what, 30 cents or $3? One of those. I'm not doing the fast math right now. Either way, it's either 30 cents or $3. All right? Just multiply it times 10,000. And so 10,000 times whatever that is, it's feeling like 1, 2, 3. I was feeling like 30 cents. You haven't correct me. 30 cents. $3. No, $3. Go four times. $3. $3. All right. Okay, so a year from now, this thing is what? $30? And you own 10,000 of them. You own 10,000 of them because you bought them for 0.0003 cents. And so you say, well, shoot, give me 10,000. Why? Why would you spend $3 on 10? Because I'm looking at what it's saying it's going to do. Just like candles, electricity. If you can believe in electricity when everybody's still believing in candles, he said, well, no. This, I've seen it. I see how it works. I believe in it. Boom. Give me 10,000. Right? So then when that $3, which you invested, but again, you got 10,000 units of it. And so when those 10,000 units become $30, so you got 30 times 10,000. So that's 300,000. How long did that take? A year? It's not pipe dream stuff I'm talking about. And there are, go to Crypto Slate. Let me get this out too. CryptoSlate.com. And since I've said that, my son, I'm going to throw up something here. Okay. I'm just trying to get you to have an idea of the field that is open to everybody in the world right now. People in the world that stay asleep. There are people in the world that stay asleep. I don't need any financial competition. Things are too shaky now. I need you to keep shaking your booty and not thinking about the booty. Allah Akbar. Okay. Look, okay. So you can go to Crypto Slate, and then when you go to assets, okay, you got CryptoSlate.com, and you can go over to the drop-down menu on it, and you drop it down, and that'll open up another menu, okay? Now, each one of these, I'm looking at, just thinking about right off the top, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, and that's not even letting them all out. 18, what you would call them ecosystems, which are, I'm going to say, they are galaxies and universes of themselves that have inside of them. Like you go to your galaxy, whatever the store is for Android, you got the Android App Store, and you got the Apple App Store, the iOS App Store, right? So there are people who, my business, themselves, the same. Their business is, I write apps for iOS. Somebody else said, I write apps for Android, right? So you just think about whatever you want to think about. So all you got to do is look on your phone. Look on your phone. And when you look on your phone, what do? You see a bunch of apps. You see a bunch of apps. The people who made the phone, Samsung didn't write those apps. Samsung did not write those apps. Somebody else wrote those apps for Samsung, for people who buy Samsung phones and they want to use the Android system. So here's an app. You can use it on your Android phone. Same way for Apple. Okay, here's an app you do. And what do the apps do? They do all the things that whatever they do. Right? Okay, that's just an example for phones. Right? In the world of finance, let's look, okay, let me open up. I'm just going to open one of these 18. Okay, and I've opened up the smart contract. There are smart contract coins. I can't elaborate on them. But the whole sector, that sector, the smart contract sector of cryptocurrency, according to this crypto slate menu here, is $364 billion. There's a $364 billion pool of money that's in the smart contract field, right? So how many accounting apps do you think that there are at in the Android phone store or in the iOS phone store? How many accounting apps? You think there are a lot? Yeah, there are a lot. So the point is, the one that's most used is the one with the greatest network effect. The one with the greatest network effect is the one that's used. Why did it get used? It's like, okay, I use this one. Somebody asked their friend, which one do you use? I use this one. No. I use social. Oh, yeah, I tried that, man, but it doesn't really work, blah, blah, blah. You have to go through all this and go through all that. Okay, well, then I'm going to go get yours. So I'm going to delete this app. I'm going to add this app. So the network effect grows in consequence of that. So I'm just going to say these names. You may not know, and it's not a recommendation. I want you to hear the names, right? So in the smart contract coins, Ethereum is just one of the smart contract coins, right? Ethereum, Cardano, Polkadot, Internet Computer, Stellar, VeChain, Ethereum Classic, Tron, EOL, Algorand, and then there's a list. This is displaying 1 of 10 out of 69 total. So the 69 other coins. So if you understand, if you understood, for example, what smart coins do, so it's what they are apps to do things in the financial world, and the people who wrote those coins, they are the beneficiaries of the network effect of that particular coin, and that's how they get their wealth, and the people who are engaging it are getting the benefit of the utility. The coin, if it's worth anything, it's doing something, it's solving a problem for you, right? So don't mess with anything unless you really understand, okay, what problem is it created to solve and how big is that problem and how well is it solving that problem? Okay, well, that's where the price, the network effect, and the value of it comes. So now you look at Ethereum, for example, we've mentioned already, like $250 billion, round figure. $250 billion. That's just one among the 69 that I'm speaking of. Following up right after it, at a distant second, is Cardano, right? Cardano is $42 billion. So basically, Cardano does the same kind of thing that Ethereum does, but the greater network effect is with Ethereum. And when I go down Polkadot and all the rest of them, they do that. So that's just one example. You can go to yield farming. You can go to insurance. You can go to all these others. And what I'm saying, brothers and sisters, is like all of them represent money to be made at the early stage of the global transformation of the international finance system. That is, the global finance system is, the sun is setting on the fiat. It's setting. And the sun is rising on the other. Now is the time. Now is the time to be able to get on something that's rising. And to be able to, like I said, the 3/10,000 and getting 10,000 of them such that when they do garner more adoption, that's where your price is going up. So if you don't have big money, I just gave you an example. It's like $3 can get you 10,000 of something that may go up 10,000 percent, and there's much less pipe dream than it sounds like. It's just that we're just not used to thinking in those. You mean that thing gonna go up 10,000%? Yeah, because it's a whole new world. It's coming up from a place of non-existence, and then what happens is the problem that it solves. That's where the network effect actually draws where the let's call it money. where the money is in the old system, like gold. Gold, for example, gold in comparison to Bitcoin. Okay, there are people that say, I'm sticking with my gold. No, I'm sticking with my gold. I'm sticking with, alhamdulillah, good. But there are other people who see that the capacity of a gold to hold value as an asset to hold value, it's not strong, and it's, even though it may be quote unquote apparently stronger in some ways and sometimes than fiat, the dollars. The point is that there's a leakage in the value of gold. So now the recognition of the power of Bitcoin to do what gold is supposed to be best at doing, that causes people to, and it's happening now, people are migrating their gold over into Bitcoin. Small percentage. We spoke last week. It's like when Bitcoin got to be 1 trillion, that was like 10% of the market cap for gold. All right? But that's a small percentage, and that's only 1 trillion. But the point is that's changing because people who hold that gold are recognizing how much stronger as a store of value Bitcoin is than gold. And so it's going to migrate more and more of the gold money, quote unquote, is going to migrate over to Bitcoin. Okay. That's what's also going to happen with all these other, not all of them, but you know what I'm saying, with these other cryptocurrencies that, okay, you know what? What you've been using to do that, this that we created, there's an app for that, right? And it can do better than that. See, yours does this. See what happens? Yours does that. See what happens? Yours does that. So look at this one. This one doesn't do that, and that. And not only does it not do that, but it also does this, that, and that. And people say, yeah, give me some of that, right? So, but see, that's when adoption happens. And those people who are the ones who are pushing, quote unquote, that coin in order to create the network effect for it, that's a part of the business. That, yeah, they do have to sell it. But the selling of it has much more to do with the utility of it and those people who genuinely find the utility and put it to use, then the network effect grows, and that creates the gravity from where that money is in that domain to come into that particular coin, for example, that 0.003 coin becoming a $30 coin. Has to do with the network effect that comes in consequence of the utility of what it is, which comes in the consequence of them telling people and more people adopting it and blah, blah. So the adoption bears on it. All right. So inshallah, you have some idea of what I'm trying to say. And so you need to do some study. I'm telling you, cryptoslate.com. Just kind of play around in there. Okay, you look in particular fields and get a feel for how things are used. Because while Bitcoin is kind of ranging between 30,000 and 40,000, whatever as it is right now, it's sort of like, you know, you kind of just Allahu Alam. This is not financial advice. Me, you know, what I'm saying, it's like okay. Nothing to do, there's nothing to sell, and if you're already doing DCA, which I recommend that you should be doing, DCA is dollar cost averaging, you should have some small slice of Bitcoin being bought, whatever, every week, every month, or whatever period. You don't have to be a lot. It just don't matter. Just keep it going. That's fine. But also, I think you should be looking for other investments. That you know, for me, you know, they should be of the same nature. I think we kind of said enough. Oh, earthquake, California, man. We just had an earthquake. I'm glad it stopped. Ooh, Lord. All right, I don't know what God is telling me about that right there. Alhamdulillah, it's got to be good. I pray everybody is safe in that respect. All right, I was about to ask some questions, but I ain't got no questions. So, alhamdulillah, may Allah have mercy on us, protect us, and guide us to the best. Everybody have a wonderful evening. Salaamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.